this infrastructure is getting on 50 years old. It's well beyond its design life. So these are issues that we should be addressing right now, and we applaud DNR for taking the first steps to do that.
Addressing aging oil and gas wells in Cook Inlet. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, UAF proposes a mobile app to help inspire energy efficiency.
I have six daughters, and so energy consumption in the home is a big deal for us.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by the Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com.
Leaders from the oil and gas industry and state regulatory agencies met in Anchorage Monday for a work session to begin the conversation about what to do with aging infrastructure in Cook Inlet. As KDLL Shaylin Cochran reports, one of the biggest questions to answer is who will be responsible.
The big takeaway from the work session was that there are a lot more questions to answer and probably even more left to ask. Presidents and other executives from several of the companies operating in Cook Inlet submitted their comments to the Division of Oil and Gas. Their main concern was not being left with the sole responsibility of dismantling or removing the oil platforms that dot the inlet once all of the reserves have been tapped. Now, considering that some of those platforms have been in use for 40-plus years and by several different companies, it poses an interesting question. Is it the state's problem or the industry's? State Senator Kathy Geisel says she's sat in on a couple of meetings like this, but she's still not sure.
Well, you know, I haven't really thought about it a lot. As someone brought up, mining companies carry the burden. So should that be put on the oil industry, the oil and gas industry? I don't know. I have to weigh that out, but I appreciated hearing the different viewpoints. There were some good points made.
Federal law dictates that mining companies are on the hook to have some sort of plan in place that wraps up operations once the mining is done, but that's not the case with platforms in Cook Inlet. Senator Peter Michicki says the question of responsibility will be determined by the final use of that equipment.
If it ends up being that the structure is for the greater good of Alaskans, we talked about power generation, if they ended up using them for something else, then it's not black and white. It depends ultimately what happens with those structures. I think for future development, those are agreements that should be made at the beginning. We should understand ultimately who's going to be responsible and what those expectations are. And I think that's the goal of the department. I think it's an honorable goal.
Industry leaders share generally the same opinion that setting aside large sums of money for future dismantling projects drains capital from current operations. Buccaneer Energy President Jim Watt told the panel that, hypothetically, a company would have a separate fund to pay for shutting things down based on production over the life of the platform or the well. But when asked by Division of Oil and Gas Director Bill Barron how the state could ensure that those funds would continue to be available as the facility changes hands, Watt said that the reality is a bit different.
Well, normally, in the terms of a transaction, the future abandonment costs are estimated. And that lessens the value of the transaction. So, that's kind of how it's viewed. So there's a future estimate of value, of costs to abandonment, and then that's established as the transaction price. So in essence, there is no transfer of funds from one company to another.
And that's what worries Cook Inlet keepers Bob Shavelson.
Industry and Alaskans and I think our governments, we all benefit from predictability. We want to see clear rules. We want to see transparency. We don't want to see a corporation hiding this money. We want it to be out in the open. So the rules need to be changed. We should do an audit. We should look at these things and understand exactly what the costs are going to be because I think that's up in the air right now.
Cook Inlet Keeper recently released a report that took a look at what those costs could be and found that, at best, the state has about half of what it might cost to dismantle, remove, or restore these facilities.
You know, most of this infrastructure is getting on 50 years old. It's well beyond its design life. So these are issues that we should be addressing right now, and we applaud DNR for taking the first steps to do that.
Everyone at the session said that a lot more work needs to be done to get the state and the industry on the same page in terms of what they expect of each other and what the best use or disuse of all those platforms will be once the oil is gone. Reporting from Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
As fall temperatures begin to slide toward lows that could be dangerous for the homeless population in Anchorage, Catholic Social Services now has the funds to staff their overflow shelter. Catholic Social Services Executive Director Susan Bomaleski says a grant from the Fred Meyer Employee Giving Fund and money from the municipality of Anchorage will get them through this winter. But Bomaleski says this Band-Aid approach is not a good long-term solution.
You know, what we need to look at is, what is the reason there's so many people in homelessness here in Anchorage? Is that, how much of it is the lack of affordable housing? How much is it lack of treatment, you know, whether it's mental health treatment or substance abuse treatment? So there needs to be a longer discussion, because, you know, we're not really interested in running a shelter, an overflow shelter, out into the future.
Catholic Social Services runs the Brother Francis Shelter, a facility that provides an evening meal and a warm place to sleep for up to 240 people a night. Bean's Cafe, across the parking lot, is used as an overflow shelter for up to 124 people on cold nights. The funding shortfall was pieced together with $30,000 from both the municipality and Fred Meyer employees. Zach Stratton is the philanthropy coordinator at Fred Meyer's Portland headquarters. He says the money is coming from a nonprofit fund created by employee giving, and Anchorage employees wanted to help the homeless.
And they came to us with this, and they understand obviously how big of a issue this homeless issue is in the Anchorage area, and with winter approaching and it getting so cold, they thought this was an important issue for us to get involved in it and see what we could do, at least for a temporary stopgap.
Federal funds that once paid for staffing the overflow shelter are gone. Bomaleski says that's at a time when they've seen a 20% increase in the number of individuals served.
5 years ago, 2008, we served about 3,000. And through the end of 2012, we served 3,600. So there's a big increase, and we're trying to figure out what's that about.
She says although they see Alaska citizens from other parts of the state landing on hard times in Anchorage, more are coming from outside the state.
Even just as soon as last weekend, you know, you see six or seven people a day coming from outside. You know, that's quite a few.
Bomaleski says they survey the people who seek help, including asking them for their last zip code. If you feel like it's been raining a lot in Anchorage, you're right. According to the National Weather Service, we've matched a record that's nearly 100 years old. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Forecaster Dave Snyder with the National Weather Service says rain is normal this time of year, but no break in the rainfall is unusual.
Today is the 18th consecutive day of measurable rain since August the 27th, so that ties the record that we set back in September of 1919. It's been a long time since it's rained this much for this long.
Measurable rainfall is considered anything more than a trace of precipitation. It's measured at the forecast office just south of the airport. There's been some minor flooding around the city because of all the rain, but nothing big. Snyder says most Anchorage records for rain are set in August and September. There's a 20% chance of showers overnight and early Saturday. And if it rains enough, Snyder says, it's possible we could break the record for consecutive days of rainfall. The monthly September rain total is nowhere near the record of 7.35 inches, which was set in September of 2004. So far, we've only had 3.79 inches of rain this September. Sunday is supposed to finally be sunny in Anchorage, with more rain expected next week. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eden.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a youth football team in Juneau adopts safer tackling techniques.
Knowing that, you know, they were doing a lot to prepare kids and have them do things right to try and prevent injury was kind of one of the things that helped us make a decision.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
A lower 48 environmental group is trying to force the Environmental Protection Agency to clamp down on fine particulate pollution in 9 states, including Alaska. The Center for Biological Diversity has filed formal notice of intent to sue the EPA for failing to enforce the Clean Air Act. The organization's Toxics and Endangered Species Campaign Director, Jonathan Evans, says the EPA has failed to press states to develop implementation plans for reducing smoke emissions.
So what this does is sets a clear framework by which the state and the EPA can work cooperatively to develop a plan to protect the environment and public health.
In Alaska, the State Department of Environmental Conservation missed a December 2012 deadline to submit a plan to reduce smoke from wood and coal burning in the Fairbanks North Pole area. The DEC is working with the EPA and Fairbanks North Star Borough to develop control measures, now scheduled to go out for public review this fall. Evans says his group welcomes that.
But until we see a plan, until we see it actually conform to the Clean Air Act, it's our obligation to hold the EPA and the state of Alaska's feet to the fire to make sure they're not dragging their heels and failing to protect public health and the environment.
Evans says the situation in Alaska is similar to what's happening in the 8 other states in the suit. The University of Alaska Fairbanks wants to develop a mobile app around energy efficiency research at its Sustainable Village student housing project. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the university will use a $40,000 donation from Verizon to run a contest for ideas and develop the app.
The app project was kicked off by University of Alaska Fairbanks and Verizon officials who gathered at the Sustainable Village. The three-house complex in the woods on the edge of campus showcases the latest in energy-efficient construction and living. UAF Office of Sustainability Director Michelle Hebert accepted a check from Verizon, a first step toward getting UAF energy efficiency knowledge onto people's smartphones.
Our main focus is to help build a bridge between the Sustainable Village and the rest of the student body and the faculty and staff and the larger community and say, what do you guys think? You know, what are our potential apps we might be able to develop?
Homes in the Sustainable Village employ a range of energy and water-saving technology, from super thick walls to solar hot water heaters and ultra-efficient boilers. But former resident and electrical engineering student Clayton Auld says most people don't get it.
Kind of this big misconception of, you know, what is it about? Are you just living down there in tents and camping out, or what are you doing?
The houses are wired to measure performance and produce a myriad of data, but Auld says it's not easy for the public to make use of.
So it's available for anybody who can log onto an FTP website. So you can download all that data, but it's just not available in a user-friendly way. So that's kind of where this app is a key part where that could kick in.
Auld thinks an app could be used to see and compare the performance of heating, energy, and water-saving technology, materials, and techniques that could help homeowners and builders. Standing outside a Sustainable Village home with a solar hot water heater, Verizon Alaska Vice President Damian Voiles said development of the app is a good fit for the wireless provider, but also has personal significance.
I have 6 daughters, and so energy consumption in the home is a big deal for us. It's a dramatic impact every month when you get your energy bill. I heard earlier that the gentlemen in this house have come up with a way by which they can consume water in a more efficient manner and significantly decrease the energy use, which in my household would equate directly to dollars.
The university plans to contract out development of the chosen app idea. There won't be a big cash prize for the winning concept, but UAF's Auld calls it a resume builder. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Sailing is thriving in the capital city through a club called Southeast Alaska Sailing, also known as SEAS. The group organizes races in the spring and summer, as well as a weekly event called Get Out the Boat. KTOO's Lisa Fu was on board the sailboat Surprise for a 3-day Labor Day weekend regatta to Taku Harbor.
7 sailboats vie for position at the start line. Then things begin to slow down. Hours are spent watching the water.
Let's see, it looks like there's some decent wind around the island, right? Like closer to the island?
Closer to the island.
Oh, it's going to be pea soup in there.
Watching the other boats
you look around always, you're asking your, you know, your wife, like, where's that boat? I just saw him behind me, and then he's on different tack.
And then you start second-guessing what you're doing because, you know, oh, that boat over there, look at they tacked, and they're going way over there, and maybe we should go over there, but I think the wind's better over here.
And when the wind is right, okay. Tacking.
Yep, let's do it. All right, helm's loose.
Brian Lieb is skipper of Haiku, a 33-foot Yamaha sailboat.
Sailing, it's entertaining to make the natural world make you go somewhere. And you're not burning fossil fuel, you're not going 30, you're not sort of bucking the world. You're trying to figure out how to make the world work for you.
Lieb is one of the founders of Southeast Alaska Sailing Club. He doesn't think it's possible to master sailing.
It's a game, right? Because we're racing, but there's all this like physics aspect to it. So it's the most complicated sport as far as like the field you're on. It changes all the time. I can't imagine basketball or football on a field that all of a sudden just tilted.
For the crew of Haiku, part of the fun of sailing is the competition. Here's Ruth Kostick.
When we started the race, our goal was to not just do whatever Surprise did. We were not going to lose Surprise.
Lieb says that's because the Haiku and Surprise split the Memorial Day Regatta.
Of the three races, they won two and we won one. And to me, that's not acceptable. Right? And so the races that they won, they had diverged from our course and they got into different air and different conditions than we were in. And my goal on the race yesterday was to camp on them.
Not every sailboat can be in front.
I'm usually near the bottom of the pack in past years, but this year we've been doing really well.
Joel Osborne is skipper of Optiminium, a 28-foot Islander sailboat.
This is the first year I've had really a gung-ho crew.
And a good crew, he says.
Somebody who's willing to get out in the rain and the wind, who's willing to deal with the weather. And beyond that, someone who's willing to learn how to sail. Someone who's got to be eagerly interested in learning how to do it right. You know, you can't just come out here every time and be willing to work. You have to be willing to think, too.
Not every sailboat has a crew. Nikolai Barkov is skipper of Cetus. It took him nearly 10 hours, but he finished his first club race almost single-handedly. With his wife Kelly and their one-year-old daughter on board, Barkov couldn't decide whether to finish the race or turn on the motor.
Probably every 30 minutes I thought, okay, maybe it's the time. And then the kind of wind maybe dies down a little bit and I kind of catch that groove. I'm like, okay, actually maybe we can do this on this tack. And then of course the wind picks up again and it starts hailing you again. Like, oh, maybe I should turn the motor on.
When the baby got sick, he thought it was time to fire it up.
She had to throw up actually and all of a sudden she got better. So I thought maybe we'll finish. So, and we did.
Back on the Surprise.
It's good.
Like, who's going to beat us, Daddy?
Whatever, dude.
Eli Krupe wasn't quite correct. For the last race of the season, Haiku didn't beat Surprise. None of the sailboats finished that day. The wind didn't cooperate. But Haiku did win the season overall and will reclaim the Seas Cup back from Surprise. Racing for the season may be over, but Get Out the Boat Wednesdays are still taking place until the end of the month. Juno sailors, new and experienced, are encouraged to get out the boat for a couple of hours after work on Wednesday and sail. In Juno, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
It's AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ben Matheson. This week on AK, junior football. It's football season in Alaska. The sport is gaining popularity in the state, where the first official high school football championship game was played less than 25 years ago. But in Alaska and nationally, concerns over football safety have grown, and a growing number of parents are refusing to let their children play youth football because of the risk of injury. Football officials at all levels have responded by trying to make the game safer. KTOO's Casey Kelly recently talked to coaches and players with the Juno Youth Football League to find out how they're approaching the problem.
Juno's Diamond Park Fieldhouse is swarming with nearly 150 6- to 14-year-old football players wearing their brightly colored team jerseys. They run around on the turf, tossing footballs, and of course trying to tackle each other. That is, until a coach summons them to the middle of the field, where he introduces former NFL quarterback Jake the Snake Plummer.
You guys like to play football, right? You want to play for a long time? All right, well then that's the key tonight, is to listen up and to pay attention when your coaches go through these drills.
At 6'2", 215 pounds, Plummer still looks fit enough to play, even though he took his last snap for the Denver Broncos in 2006. After he became a coach, he says he realized young players today are not being taught proper techniques. Specifically, too many players are learning the wrong way to tackle.
Don't use that helmet as a weapon. That thing's there to protect you. That's like a shield. That's not your sword. That's a shield to protect your head from getting injured.
Plummer is now an ambassador for USA Football, the official youth development organization of the NFL and its Players Association. Juno Youth Football League Director of Coaching Brandon Molly says JYFL became a full-fledged member of USA Football this year to take advantage of its certified training programs.
You get online, usafootball.com, and they have certifications from tackling to flag football. They complete their certifications, give them to me, and then they're eligible to coach for the season.
During his visit to Juno, Plummer led a clinic on heads-up tackling, which teaches players to keep the crown of their helmet up and their eyes on the player they're trying to take down. The idea is to limit injuries like concussions or stingers, which are basically pinched nerves in the neck. Molly says JYFL coaches have also gone to a limited tackling policy in practices. He says many NFL and college teams have similar policies.
They have found that you can go what's called thud level, which is hit to contact without taking kids to the ground, that you can achieve the same level at practice as you could hitting to take kids to the ground, and you have much less injuries in the process.
Juno youth football coach Craig Campbell says some parents are skeptical of limited or heads-up tackling practices, but overall, he thinks it's a positive step.
You see some people going against it because they're always taught, you know, hit low, this diving tackle. So it's trying to change that perception, and it just takes time. And I really see the biggest benefit we're going to see is the younger kids growing up.
Mike Carricker's son, Noah, plays for the Seahawks of the Cubs division. As a parent, he applauds the new emphasis on safety.
I was really hesitant, didn't want him involved, worried about injuries, and but he was persistent, and that last month it was every day, Daddy, can I play? Daddy, can I play? So we gave in, but knowing that, you know, they were doing a lot to prepare kids and have them do things right to try and prevent injury was kind of one of the things that helped us make a decision.
Heads-up tackling is on full display at a recent game between the senior division Hawkeyes and Red Raiders. Hawkeyes quarterback/running back Liam Vansickle says he's never had a concussion, and he hopes heads-up tackling means he never will.
I think it's just as effective, and it's a lot safer. I've had people on my team get, like, stingers and stuff. I think that this is a good way to help prevent that.
Most importantly, Vansickle says the new focus on safety won't change the way he plays aggressively. In Juno, I'm Casey Kelly.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're headed to Nelchina, a small and spread out community on the Glen Highway.
My name is Roxanne Farmer. I live at Nelchina, Alaska. Nelchina is a place on the Glen Highway. It's a town site from Eureka, maybe 2 mile 150 on the Glen Highway. It was people came in and did some gold mining in the 1900s. Different people do some mining back in behind Eureka, and people do some recreational mining along the streams and creeks. I think the miners used to do real well in the 70s and 80s, but I think now it's just more recreational. We have a local church. We have a couple lodges on the highway, Eureka Lodge being one, and Mendelton Lodge being at the other end. Slide Mountain Cabins is in between there. In the 70s, is a lot like what it's like now. We had kind of like a boom in the 80s and 90s. We had more people in this area. We had a lot more families. We ended up putting in a little school here. And just over the last 10 years, our community just dwindled back down again to where we just have a lot of people that have recreational homes in the area. There's not a lot of people that stay here all winter long. So the school has been closed down. So many people do a lot of dip netting and get fish from the fish wells there in Copper Center. And a lot of people go down and do silver fishing down in Valdez in the summertime. And then we all, yes, definitely harvest our caribou and our moose in this area. We have the Chugach Mountain Range that's on the south side of the highway. From one point, you could see all four mountain ranges: Chugach, Talkeetna, the Wrangells, and the Alaska Range.
Roxanne Farmer is a lifelong resident of Neltchina. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Casey Kelly, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ben Matheson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. Ben Matheson was our AKA guest host this week. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.